Hey everyone, welcome back. This episode was recorded live on the soundstage in the Expo Hall at VMX. It's sponsored by Antech and features Dr. Holly Brown and Jessica Wilson-Hess, who is not only a certified veterinary technician, but also a veterinary technician specialist in internal medicine. We started off this episode talking about what I consider kind of a miracle dog who came through not only Lyme nephritis, but also survived anaplasmosis. I'm thinking that must be a pretty robust tick population in that area. And we certainly spend some good time reviewing hematology topics like stress leukogram and next diagnostic steps when thrombocytopenia is noted on a CBC. But discussing this case also gave us the opportunity to talk about the important relationship between veterinarians and veterinary technicians. I know it goes without saying, but each of us plays a vital role in patient care and the client experience. I have to say, I really appreciated Jessica's, shall we call it, gentle acknowledgement of her ability to translate doctors' words into manageable information and recommendations for pet owners. That is certainly one of the many skills I so appreciate in the wonderful technicians I've had the pleasure of working with throughout the years. I almost feel like there's like a certain look that comes across their faces, and when I see it, it says, you're spinning in your own head, doc, you're overthinking it, and try as I might to rein it back in, I know as soon as I walk out of that room, they're going to look at the owner and say, okay, that was a lot. Let me translate that into some non-overwhelming plain English for you. So I really appreciated that part of the conversation, and I appreciate that skill of really being able to pull out and apply that relevant information when I know I'm getting buried in my own brain, spinning with differentials and diagnostics and if this, then that. Another part of our conversation that I really appreciated was the discussion of how invested we all are in the positive outcomes for our patients and how we really take their care and their outcomes kind of personally, whether that's a healthy way to approach things or not. I think when we're all invested in our patients like this, it fosters this amazing relationship focused on teamwork, and it helps us do our jobs better and learn and grow together, which ultimately leads to excellent care for our patients. A little bit more about our speakers. I'll start with Dr. Holly Brown. Holly's a veterinarian and board-certified clinical pathologist. She practiced small animal medicine before, during, and after her specialty training, grateful to have combined her love of clinical practice and the laboratory diagnostics that support it. Holly remains in the trenches at a general referral and emergency practice. She loves making an impact at the interface of laboratory data and patient care. Holly recently transitioned into her new role as Chief Veterinary Educator for Antech Diagnostics, exercising her passion for delivering education about maximizing diagnostic testing. And Jessica Wilson-Hess. Jessica has been a technician for over 15 years and a VTS in small animal internal medicine for 8 years. She's worked in the university setting and more recently at a large hybrid practice. Her primary focuses have been in internal medicine, nutrition, and clinical pathology, but truthfully, she enjoys almost everything about vet med. I feel that, Jessica. I feel the same way. She grew up in a family of educators, and like many other children of teachers, she loves to teach. This passion for educating led her to a new role with Antech, where she's helping with the development of education centered around laboratory diagnostics and point-of-care instrumentation. Jessica loves teaching other technicians and nurses about laboratory medicine and clinical pathology and how they can have a true impact on patient outcome and care through the lab. In her words, it's a place where technicians can really shine. All right, let's go ahead and jump into it. Like I said, such a wonderful conversation. And if you enjoy listening to Holly and Jessica, they also have a podcast called Tales from the Lab, and that's T-A-I-L-S, that you should definitely check out wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining me. Before we get started, can you each tell us a little bit about yourselves?
My name is Jessica, and I am a certified veterinary technician, and I also have a veterinary technician specialty and small animal internal medicine. And I currently work for Antech, working on product development and also education centered around diagnostics.
I'm Holly Brown, and I'm a clinical pathologist, so a veterinarian specialist, and I've had a really unique position since leaving academia as an on-staff clinical pathologist at a large, bustling general referral and emergency hospital. which has been really fun, you know, right, to be that close to the cases.
Yeah.
As a clinical pathologist. And then more recently took a position with Antech as our chief veterinary educator. Worked together with Jessica in the hospital setting and now over in Antech, and we really love doing education, so.
Well, that's fantastic. And so we're going to touch on all of that today. We're going to talk about education, but then also working together and the relationship that you have that's allowing you to provide this excellent patient care. So to kind of kick that off, we have a case, Sammy. Tell us about Sammy.
Okay, so I'll get started where we start with everything in vet med, the sigglement.
Love that.
So Sammy is a 7-year-old male neutered Labrador that came to our animal hospital all the time. He was a regular patient, and it started out for Sammy with Lyme nephritis. That's why he originally presented. And we do some stem cell therapy kind of experimentally to treat renal disease in patients. And Sammy actually received stem cells initially for his Lyme nephritis, recovered from that. And his owners reported to us that he felt so much better after stem cell therapy. So sometimes they can be used to treat arthritis. So they continued on with his renal stem cell therapy to treat his arthritis. So he was a frequent flyer at our animal hospital and one of my patients that I saw on a fairly regular basis. So I had a great relationship with his owners. And he had come in for stem cell therapy, and we always do CBC chemistry and electrolytes on them to just kind of double check where things are. So we had a lot of baseline data on him, and this becomes important later on in the case because we have this healthy patient data and we have something to compare to when something goes wrong. So Sammy had his stem cell therapy, everything went great, it was unremarkable. And he came back about a week later, really sick. So the first thing in my mind is what happened? Is this related to the stem cells? Did something go wrong either with their preparation or the administration? And I tend to be like, it was my fault right off the bat. So, you know, I'm in the room talking to his owners. They're saying how lethargic he is. He's just kind of out on laying down on the floor. He's a lab, so they're bouncy and, you know, crazy when they feel good. And when I took his temperature, it was 104.3. So he's also febrile. So I talk to his owners, tell them, you know, how concerned I am and that we're going to want to run some lab work on him to start with, see where we are with his CBC and his chemistry and electrolytes.
So we get back his CBC results. So we like to start with a CBC as a great sort of first check of overall health, right? It has very sensitive indicators of disease states with an anemia or signs of inflammation or something off of the platelets. So, and we get our CBC results fast, right? We get them within
sure.
a couple minutes off of our in-clinic analyzers. So we look at his CBC results. Actually, when we put it all together, the most significant changes were in the CBC. And especially in contrast to what it looked like 5 to 7 days previously, right, when he had been there, we see that he has, in the leukogram, in his white blood cells, decreased lymphocytes and decreased eosinophils. And when we see that pattern, that's because of increased glucocorticoids or a stress response, right, a really good sick patient test, right? It's not specific to what's going on.
Sure.
But it validated these clinical signs, right? So we're looking for objective data to put behind the behaviors that we're seeing, right?
Right.
And so, oh yeah, we have the sick patient indices, right, telling us that's what's going on, at least for starters, substantiates that. Interestingly, you know, presumably we're in the face of some inflammatory disease given his fever, right, his lethargy, et cetera. And yet, sometimes the CBC, the whole numbers don't tell that whole story, right?
Sure.
Because he had no increased total white cell count, no increased neutrophils, increased monocytes, our typical inflammatory leukograms.
Right.
Right, and that's really just because the whole numbers don't tell the whole story because it's really a balance, right, between the tissue demand, whatever the disease process, and the bone marrow meeting it.
Sure.
Right, and so if you can detect a left shift, right, something like that to help us, because the whole numbers might not tell the whole story.
But right.
In this case, they did it, right? So normal total neutrophil count, normal monocyte count. But he did have a thrombocytopenia. I'll let Jessica speak to what we do when we see these reported, right? Because
yes.
We believe that we've become, as practitioners, right, desensitized to seeing low platelet counts.
When you say a stress response, you don't mean stress like I was stressed. You mean a different type of stress.
Absolutely. Yeah, you look at that and it's kind of one of those that's easy to brush off. And, you know, burying my soul again here on the podcast, sometimes what I'll do is
it's like if I can't find any other reason, then I'm like, maybe that is real. And not to say I don't go back and check it regularly, but it's not always a red flag when I initially see that thrombocytopenia.
Right, because those are actually different leukogram changes, right? Because there's like an excitement, you have epinephrine-induced changes, and that we see actually lymphocytes go up.
Right.
But this is increased glucocorticoids, right, our steroid hormone. That really means the body's in some duress, right, for a period of time significant enough that they're increasing their adrenal secretion, right, of glucocorticoids. And we just happen to see some of the changes in this white cell distribution because of it.
I'm so glad that you brought that up because, yes, like those excitement leukograms can really kind of throw you off sometimes. You're like, why are these lymphocytes so high? But, yeah, so to make that distinction between, you know, the stress leukogram from increased cortisol secretion, increased glucocorticoids versus like just a lab that's happy to see you.
Yeah, right, right. Or caffeine restrained.
Yes. Those oh, yeah.
And restriction with anxiety.
Or Jessica.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so thrombocytopenia.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you that we become kind of numb to them. And I think as a technician, those thrombocytopenias really start with how we're collecting the blood. So having a nice, clean stick, you know, using the largest vessel that we can possibly use, whether that's the jugular or saphenous vein, a nice lab like Sammy, we're going to probably use this jugular vein, and really trying to minimize the amount of redirection that we have from our blood draw. So if we know that our sample collection was good, then we can start to really investigate those thrombocytopenias. And it starts when we pull those results off of the printer, whoever that is, whether it's the technician that ran the lab work or whether it's the doctor, we can't just ignore those. So we have a couple of things that we can do. One is we can utilize our cytograms and our histograms that are on almost all CBCs. And I know a lot of people ignore them, but we can see platelet clumping on those. And we can also see the thrombocytopenias. So that would be a first spot. If you don't feel comfortable looking at those, then another place that you can go to the microscope, and you can look at the actual blood film. So we're going to see those platelet clumps at the feathered edge of our blood film because they are large. So when we make the blood film, we're pushing those larger cells as we're rolling things across the slide, we're pushing those larger cells out to the edge. So that's where we're going to see larger cells. We can sometimes see organisms out there, or we can see the platelet clumps out there. If there are platelet clumps present, then we know that we can't really trust the thrombocytopenia and we have to take it as it is, or we can get a new sample. If we don't have any platelet clumps, then that's when we can go back into the monolayer of the film and we can do an estimated platelet count. And there's equations out there, or there's rough estimates that we can get that tell us, kind of put it in the bucket of too low, normal, and if it's elevated as well.
And one thing that I love, of course, as a clinical pathologist, for me to hear Jessica emphasize is that the quality of the sample that we're getting, like
yeah.
how important that is. And a big part of what we focus a lot of our education around, anytime we're going to talk about lab work, is to always mention those pre-analytic variables, right? And so we are so dependent on our technicians and their skill sets, right, of getting great samples, of handling them properly, of running them through the analyzers properly, right? We have an adage in the clinical pathology world of like a crap in equals crap out.
Do you mean sure?
Your results are only as good as the sample you introduced, right? And so we really love using our skilled technicians and assistants, right, to get the highest quality samples so that we feel most confident about the results.
Sure.
I feel like crap in, crap out is the PG version because that's not actually what he's saying.
And it applies to so many scenarios.
Yeah.
But we won't get into that right
yeah.
now. And just a clarifying question. I think I know the answer to this. You know, assuming you get your lab work back and you have your liver values are okay and all of this, with the thrombocytopenia, not necessarily a concern for a jugular blood draw.
Yeah, right. So I guess it would depend on what level the thrombocytopenia is, right?
Sure.
So if you had a severe thrombocytopenia, we've had scenarios where they had no outward signs of bleeding or coagulopathy, right? And then you do a jugular stick, and then you find out they actually have no platelets. They just were being challenged.
Surprise.
Right? And you go back to the patient. Yeah, right. And there's a swelling there, right? So generally, I mean, it takes like an immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, something if they're not in DIC, right,
sure.
to have that low of platelets to actually see, you know, hemorrhage from the blood draw, right? So usually, and actually I think that's a great point to think about, is that one of the first things we think of when we see a reported pretty severe thrombocytopenia is, does that fit the clinical picture, right? Does that make sense? Because you'd be surprised if we just poked and prodded this patient and they had no platelets and we didn't see any outcome of that, right? It might look again at sample quality, look back for a clot in the tube or something like that.
Sure, that makes sense. That makes it just
to that point, obviously, if we saw a patient that had petechial hemorrhage like anywhere on their body, we wouldn't be poking a jugular vein. We were going for saphenous or, So I just, it is important to make sure that you have that clinical picture in combination before you do your blood draw. But I think we've all been there where we've been like, go back and check that patient. Make sure we don't have bleeding from our jugular vein, but
So how severe was the thrombocytopenia? Did you have these issues with Sammy? And what ultimately ended up being the cause there?
Perfect. So as we looked across his blood film, he had no platelet clumps at the feathered edge. We looked at the cytograms and the histograms that also did not support there being any platelet clumps. It looked like a verified or true thrombocytopenia. I don't remember the number offhand, but I believe our estimate was around 70,000 platelets per microliter. And as we looked at his blood film, and in particular, we're concentrating on that feathered edge initially, right? And as we do our platelet estimate back in the body of the film, we notice another significant change. So for him, within some of his neutrophils, and again, preferentially those that were pushed out to the feathered edge, right, is that we saw there was an intracellular inclusion, right? So in describing, and I'll do my best to do it justice, but a relatively round inclusion that looks like it's sort of made of little dots in it. And so what we call that is a rickettsial morula, and it's evidence for a tick-borne transmission of a bacterial cocci. And when the neutrophils, which are phagocytic cells, right, they help us destroy against invaders, right? So within the phagosome, one of the organelles that's used to destroy some infectious agent like this, it engulfs the bacteria, the cocci, but the cocci is able to withstand that environment and replicate. And so you get this mulberry-like appearance within a circular field, if that makes sense, within the neutrophil. So when we see that, it's evidence for tick-borne disease, right? So seeing those morulae, we know we had a tick-transmitted infection. And then we have to think of who it is, right? So within neutrophils, and it depends on the area of the country that you're in and the tick vector for it, but it's either Anaplasma phagocytophilum or Ehrlichia ewingi.
Sure.
So one of those.
Yeah. Right? One of those that none of us like to see. And I feel like I'm like going back to my vet school days here where when my wonderful clin path professor said, always evaluate a blood film. This is like the perfect reason why we need to do that is validate the thrombocytopenia and then finding that morula. Because let's talk for a minute about tick testing in, you know, especially with an acute presentation.
Right, right. So I think when we think about vector-borne disease testing, we think of our screening tests that we use often more in health scenarios, right? So when we look at whether we do the in-clinic or at the reference lab, when we look at Ehrlichia testing, Lyme disease testing, and our Anaplasma, those are actually antibody tests in those screening tests, right? And so I think of that works well with Lyme disease because of a dog that's infected and is showing clinical signs, that's weeks to months out from when it's initially infected. So you are in that more chronic state where antibody levels are measurable.
Sure.
Right? But for anaplasmosis, right, they show acute symptoms, right? So he's showing up with acute clinical signs. And then when we go to test our vector-borne disease screening test and we see that negative, it just means it's negative for antibodies.
Right.
Right? That can be really confusing.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's actually, so in a contrast to Lyme, anaplasmosis is an acute disease. They don't have enough antibodies yet to turn those tests positive.
Got it.
And so we actually often caution people that in a very sick dog that has anaplasma antibodies that test positive on these vector-borne disease screening tests, it's actually less likely to be anaplasmosis. Got it? They've been exposed sometime in the past. They already have antibodies.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And then we can do one step better, and that is we can request PCR from the reference lab to actually genetically distinguish whether it's Anaplasma phagocytophilum or Ehrlichia ewingi.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So in our area, central Pennsylvania, we see very little Ehrlichia, right? So we have Ixodes ticks in our area. Ixodes transmit Lyme, but also anaplasmosis.
Got it.
Right? It's the amblyomma ticks that we see more in the southern part of the U.S., and they're the ones that are going to transmit their Ehrlichias.
And is Ehrlichia also going to present acutely like that, or is that mostly anaplasma?
You know, I don't have enough clinical experience, so we really don't see it up in Pennsylvania, so I really can't speak to it. I would not expect as acute a presentation. I think it is more a chronic fulminant presentation.
Okay.
Yeah, our anaplasma dogs feel awful. They present down and out, and sometimes it can be pretty scary, especially we've seen some older patients recently that are, you know, geriatrics, and they look like they're on death's door. It can be pretty scary.
And I think it's so scary because it's so acute in onset, right? That is such a fast change in clinical presentation that owners are very, very upset, right? And it can be a challenge to make that diagnosis in the practice setting because those, again, our typical tick-borne disease screening tests won't catch it, right? So it's recognizing that stress response, which is we see every single time. We really do in those acute infections, that stress response and that thrombocytopenia that hopefully got someone to look at a blood film or send to the reference lab to review to verify the thrombocytopenia, if nothing else, and then catching those morulae, and then you could do the PCR testing on top of it.
So do we have a timing concern with the morulae? Like, do we have to make the blood film within a certain amount of time of collecting the blood, or will it stay in that neutrophil even if we, like, go back later and we're like, oh, we should really check a blood film?
Fresh is always best. So making your blood films pretty much immediately after you do your CBC is going to be your best chance.
And certainly as far as any cell preservation, right? But as opposed to like some of the epicellular cocci that we can see with like a mycoplasmas, et cetera, that will literally fall off the membrane. These won't fall off. They just won't preserve as well. And so potentially it might look like a broken cell, free nuclei, something like that.
But so. I think that also brings up a good point of how many times our DiffQuicks have been sitting there forever and have chunks of precipitate in them. So that we want to make sure, if usually what we do is if we find one cell where maybe they're not inside, those morula are not inside, but they're kind of next to it because the cell's broken, we try to look around to see them intercellularly just so that we're not, you know, calling something that was truly stain precipitate, and then also making sure you change your DiffQuick on a regular basis.
Yes, all very important. And I'm also picturing, you know, if you go and you're like, oh, this is thrombocytopenia and I'm suspicious of anaplasma, like, it's not really a patient you want to go and poke again. So yeah. Good advice to just make that blood film right away.
Yeah, and we will say that time and time again, is that especially in our sick patients, like, even if you don't go back to the blood film, but while you have the fresh blood, it's just to have one made. At our practice, we will have a blood film paired with every CBC that we run. Many of them remain unstained in a slide rack. Right, but we'll go back to it if there's abnormalities in the differential, we're concerned about morphology changes or infectious agents. It's sitting there from a fresh sample, right? Yeah.
Oh, Dr. Wamsley, she told us, always make a blood film with that CBC.
Yeah, it can save you sometimes, right?
Sure.
Save the animal.
And if you are sending stuff to the reference lab, I think it's helpful for the clinical pathologists that are there to have a fresh blood film, just so they can kind of pick apart those aging changes that you can sometimes have, because they're going to make a blood film on a sample that's, you know, 24 hours old versus you can make one fresh in your hospital.
That's a really good point. Yeah, to think about just having that blood film ready to go just in case. All right, well, we're going to pivot here, but tick-borne disease is always complicated and exciting to talk about, so I don't know what question is next. Excited. This is live podcasting. Give us some closure here of, was Sammy okay?
So is Jessica okay? Let's talk about that.
Let's start with, is Jessica okay?
So I have a huge sigh of relief, because not that I'm excited that he has anaplasma, but I'm excited because it's something that I know that we can treat, that we can fix. So I have a sigh of relief, and then I get to really help Sammy feel better. So we ended up hospitalizing him on some fluids just to kind of perk him up a little bit, and also some doxycycline for the treatment of the tick-borne disease. And the cool thing about anaplasma, especially in these acute cases, is most of the time, the next day, they're completely back to normal. So it's like a miracle treatment, because, you know, they come in super down and out, and then we give them fluids and an antibiotic, and they're feeling so much better the next day. So he ended up going home the following day. So like 24 hours later, I get to give Sammy back to his mom and dad, super happy, wagging his tail back to his normal self.
I actually felt like, you know, he had gotten that stem cells the week previously, right? And so my story goes, like, maybe they made him feel so good with his arthritis that he was out romping around in the woods more than he would have normally been, or something. He was feeling so good that he got exposed to the tick that got him in this pickle, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But we write it in. We rechecked his lab work at the end of his antibiotics, right? So again, Sammy's one of the dream patients that we've been able to get all this routine data on, right?
Right.
To know what's normal for him, right? And give us a chance, especially one thing we will see in our more mature patients that might have comorbidities, right? Some of them take a little longer to treat. right? Some of them don't respond as quickly. Their immune system isn't as robust. They're working on something else or whatever it is. It's really nice to see in him, given his lab work looking so clean and normal, you know, week previously, that the end of his doxycycline treatment, we repeated his CBC and chemistry, everything back to, you know, normal SAMI values.
Amazing.
And just kind of to round it out, I think it's important when we have something like this, so we have a transmission of a tick-borne disease. This is a dog that had Lyme nephritis previously. Now he has anaplasma, is to make sure that we're on some type of preventative. And he was indeed on a preventative. And that's the, you know, kind of crux of anaplasma is to be transmitted. They don't have to have that long bite like they do with Lyme. So you can still have these breakthrough infections even when you're on a flea and tick preventative.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just transmitted so fast. And this is like the Labrador with nine lives. Like, he came through. Because Lyme nephritis in general has a very poor prognosis. So for him to have survived Lyme nephritis and then survived anaplasma, like, that is a lucky dog.
And I think you also bring up a great point in that we do vector-borne screening for just that reason, as screening tests, right? As part of, you know, annual wellness or biannual wellness exams. And I think when we do get any positive results, that there's other implications beyond that patient, right? It's telling us what's in your environment.
Sure.
What tick vectors that you have there, right? What they're transmitting, and then who everyone else is susceptible to in your area, right? I tell the story about anaplasmosis all the time, is that when I started practicing in Pennsylvania, and Jessica and I were together, there were years before we saw anaplasmosis in our area. So as we know, vectors are moving, they're expanding, people are moving, all that other stuff. And so we really didn't see any cases of anaplasmosis. And then they started coming in, and they've been with us, you know, ever since. We had had it in our area for a couple of years, and I was at the pediatrician, and you know, as Jessica said, very dramatic presentation, right? Owners are wrought with fear. Do you mean because they were just doing great, and now it looks really, really bad, you know, very out of character for their pet. And I asked my pediatrician, like, what's this going to look like if my kids get it? We camp, we bike, you know, we're outside. I said, what's it look like in people? And she said, oh, we don't have it here. And I was like, well, you do.
Surprise.
And so, like, if you don't tap, right? Like, we do actually some really good sentinel screening, right?
Yeah.
I don't think they do as well in human medicine, right?
Oh, I could go down that rabbit hole, and I'm going to refrain because now I have so many more questions.
But it's really great that it has implications beyond SAMI, right? And we now know it's in our area. We need to watch other pets for it. And as Jessica said, we know our tick control is inadequate, right? You got to come up with some other strategies because they're getting through.
And it's a really good point because that is, you know, it is transmitted so quickly that it changes the conversation with owners around tick prevention of like, look, this is not like a if you find a tick on them kind of situation. This is, we really need to be proactive because this is here in the environment and it can get really bad really fast. Well, now that we know Sammy is the Labrador with nine lives, that's amazing that he survived both of those things. Well done to both of you. Let's talk about your stress response, your elevated lymphocytes and neutrophils on his presentation. It sounds like you're just taking a lot of ownership in that case. And I would have had the exact same reaction of like, oh, what did I do? What went wrong? But taking a lot of ownership there, I mean, it sounds like you're taking a big role in patient care, kind of practicing to the top of your license, if you will. I don't know if that's too cliche at this point, but can you talk a little bit about that and, you know, what that looks like for you and why that's important?
Yes.
Wonderful.
Oh, suddenly I got very nervous. I was good on the
It was
patient.
A very roundabout question,
so
it took me a while to get there. I kind of built it up.
I mean, I'm an old lady technician. I've been a tech for almost 20 years at this point in time. And so I've really got to see the profession change over the course of those 20 years and see the roles of technicians and nurses really develop and see us kind of spread our wings and grow with things like, you know, BTSs, and we're taking leadership roles more and more and taking ownership of our profession. So my own way of looking at patients has changed. It's not really just the doctor that I'm working with's patient, it's my patient too. These are people that I'm developing relationships with, the clients that I'm developing relationships with, and I become really invested in them and their overall care. So that ownership of those cases has really helped me become a better technician, I think. And also things like mentorship from lovely doctors. We were talking about this over lunch, and I said I was almost like a a person walking through the desert looking for a drink. You know, I really wanted that mentorship from a doctor who would believe in me and trust me and teach me things. And that's really, I think, for her and I, how our relationship grew from just doctor and technician to really a true friendship. I always joke and say she came to Metzger Animal Hospital, found the love of her life, which is me. But it's, you know, the investment that she put into me really made me a better technician.
I love that. And I would love to hear, Dr. Brown, you know, I'd love to hear you guys just talk about that relationship and how that formed into, like you said, a true friendship, but also, you know, real teammates who are working together to help patients survive Lyme nephritis and anaplasma.
I mean, I think in the realm of diagnostics is the best way where you both are such important team members, right? In getting that data and maximizing that information, right? It's equally as reliant on her investment and skill set as it is in mine, right? And so I think the relationships work in the hospital in those settings best when there's mutual respect for what each team member brings, right? Everything from who is making the appointment is greeting them at the front desk, right? All the way through the final treatments and the go-homes, right? Is that everyone has such an important role in there. And if we're able to support each other to maximize what we're able to do in those roles, right, we're all more successful, right? I mean, I could do my job as a clinical pathologist if I didn't have laboratory technicians, right, who are doing their job the best as well, right? So it's not just a selfless mentorship, right? Like,
right?
It's mentorship because I can do my job better, right, when we're doing this together.
Absolutely. And I'm hearing a lot of like communication of, you know, this is what's important for this patient and this is how we're going to accomplish this and this is what you're going to do and this is what I'm going to do and this is how it's all going to come together to benefit the patient. So it sounds like you've also developed a really seamless communication to be able to come together and treat patients.
Yeah. And that's not to say we don't have our bad days where I roll my eyes at her and I'm huffy. But yes, you know, and I think the other thing too is we are in such a stressful profession. We're going to be stressed out. We're going to be worn thin sometimes, and giving one another grace, I think, is so important. Like, you don't always know what's going on with your teammates, you know, outside of work. You don't always know what's going on, you know, in a doctor's life or the stress that they have from their position. And just being able to take a step back and think, okay, Holly was really quiet today. I know it's not about me. Make sure you check in with your teammates, make sure they're okay, and give one another grace and room to have a bad day, because I can definitely have my bad days. So I appreciate that from my teammates, and in particular with Dr. Brown, someone you're working so closely with on a day-to-day basis in the trenches. I mean, I'm sure everyone, all the listeners, can relate to trauma bonding and how stressful that med can be. And it really forms these bonds that, you know, even years down the road, maybe you haven't seen that person in years, but that bond that you made in the trenches really unites you and creates these friendships that are so strong.
And I also think that, I mean, Jessica, you're unique in your talents and all your skill sets that you bring.
My face.
Your face.
But, and those amazing glasses, like, I love these. They're catching the light perfectly. Like,
but I think that it's all of our support staff, right? Our technicians and our assistants are probably equally as thirsty and invested in these cases,
yeah.
Right? And so we certainly have found at our hospital, you know, the more we can share about the case, the more the doctors could share with the technicians and through all levels, right, of the care team. The more knowledge that we can share, the more everyone's on that same team together, I think the more reward our technicians get out of their jobs.
Yeah.
Right? So
yeah,
they're not
absolutely.
Just tech.
Right.
Right? There's
oh
no just in our language, right?
Yes.
Because there's so much that they're able to do if they're empowered to do so. Right? So by supporting and empowering them through the knowledge of the case, they do the incredible communication with the clients. They do some of the really heavy lifting, right? And can only do that job really well. Right? When we're mentoring them, when we're sharing the information, when we're learning together.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'd love to dive into some of the specifics of what each of you kind of felt like made it work, because I feel like it went beyond just that trauma bond, although that is a very real thing. But there were probably specific actions that each of you took to say, hey, you know, I trust you, you trust me, and vice versa. And let's work together to do this that helped forge that relationship and that trust.
Well, I would say it was the daily green tea lattes that I brought you.
Oh, yeah.
From Starbucks.
That's love.
Yeah, that is.
Matcha latte, sorry.
That is. So when are you coming to Florida, Tori?
we probably both can speak to a little separately, but I think for sure, I think it's when I maybe noticed it initially the most and dug in deeper to develop it is watching Jessica's communication after we've discussed a case together, right? She's processing lab. She has questions about things. She always asks questions.
Yeah.
Fantastic, right? I'm just concerned about this, or is it right if I say this, right? And so we'll talk through it together. And then when I hear her repeat that, you know, and educate our other doctors, our other technicians, when she's talking to the client, do you know what I mean? I feel like really builds my trust, right? She's asking the right questions. She never is going to presume something, right? And then I feel like she is one of our best representatives going outward to the client or, you know, beyond that, because we discuss the case together. She has full knowledge of it. She's invested. She brings a whole nother perspective about the patient because she was in the room with them. She had her hands on them more, right? Yeah, that actually helps to build out my confidence around the case as well.
So mine is the other side of that, which is when I ask the questions, when I'm coming to her all the time, it's like a safe space. She's always willing to answer my questions. It doesn't matter how busy she is. She's not short with me. There are no stupid questions with her. Like she's so very intelligent and articulate. And I'm just sometimes over there like trying to find the right words. And she's just always willing to share with me. And so, you know, it's I scratch your back, you scratch mine, really. You know, she invested in me. And so that made me want to work harder for her. That made me want to do more for her, go above and beyond. And yeah, I think that's really where that friendship came from. And we had to stay in a really cruddy hotel in Scranton together after we'd known each other for like 6 months. We did a talk.
That's a trauma bond right there.
Yeah, it was the weirdest thing. She was like, you want to go talk with me? And I'm like, sure. And we ended up going and talking. And I think doing things outside of work together, also, you know, seeing one another as not just a veterinarian, not just a technician, but as moms, as wives,
yeah,
as
the
friends.
Whole self, right?
Yeah,
the whole
as a whole person.
I think you talked about creating that safe space. And I think it was probably only when I was equally as comfortable that I could start saying what I didn't know too, right? To be like, I'm a specialist, like I'm supposed to know. But there were times where I was like, I don't know.
Right.
She's the best researcher. So like I'm moving on to the next case, and she's like, "Oh, we don't know this. I'm gonna find out." She comes in with articles the next day. Do you know?
Amazing.
And not just the matcha latte. Not articles
and an article with research. Man, that is love right there.
You have to email them to her and print them out because she likes them in both formats to file and also to write on.
See, and you know that about it too. I was kind of laughing when because I think each of you spoke to it separately about the you know, you were talking about Jessica going out and being able to talk to the client and be a good representative to speak with them. Jessica, you were like, when I'm like, I can't think of what to say, you know, Holly will give you the words. And like, I have felt that so deeply to say, okay, this is what I'm thinking. And then had the technician that I'm working with turn around and like say it in plain English. I'm like, yes, that. Can you say that? Because I can't say that.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that's part of our jobs as technicians and nurses.
And it's so appreciated.
Decode whatever the doctor just came in and said to the poor clients who are like, there were a lot of really big words in that.
And that relationship with clients is everything,
right?
I mean, that's how we got them in the door. That's how they're going to be successful when they leave, right?
Right.
And our technicians carry that weight,
yes,
right, of those communications.
Yeah.
So I think, again, the more knowledge we can empower them with, right, the more effective those communications are, and then the better outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like better compliance, better value in what we've provided,
yeah,
right? And again, that's a big thing around laboratory diagnostics or any diagnostics, right? Is reviewing results with the owners, right?
Right.
Because they've just invested in financially, invested in their time, invested emotionally, right, to try and get some answers in the testing. And we do really empower our technicians to try to understand the lab work as well, right? We'll go through it together because everyone needs to do it, all hands on deck.
Sure.
Right? And so being able to go over some lab work changes, right, because they're empowered and understand these changes and have that communication with the owner shows that value in that testing that was done, right? And then again, gets them more invested in either further diagnostics or the appropriate treatments. We get better compliance, right? Better reward.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I'm like having so many thoughts because I'm going even like normal lab work results. I hate the like, oh, it's normal, you're all good. Like, no, the red blood cells and the white blood cells were within the normal range. Liver and kidney values were okay. 40X was negative. Fecal didn't show any, you know, like really going through and showing that value and that communication part of it.
100%, right? Because otherwise you've really devalued, Yes. Right? Like you just said, like, why did I pay $200?
Right. I could have told you he was fine.
Yeah, right, right. These are all the things that we tested, right?
Yes.
And this is what you just paid for. This is actually what we wanted to see.
Right.
Right? That's actually invaluable.
Yes, right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think that brings up a really good point of making sure that everyone on the team feels like they can have those discussions, because we've all been in an exam room for a go home or to talk to a client, and maybe we don't know quite as much as we should about the patient, and then we get asked a question and we're like, ugh. So if we have those foundations, that knowledge, we can better communicate with our clients. And that's, I do think, you know, we're talking about a doctor and technician mentorship, but that also goes for technicians mentoring technicians, technicians mentoring assistants, you know, doctors mentoring doctors. Like we all, the smarter our team is, like the gatekeeping needs to stop. We need to make sure we're sharing the knowledge with everybody, because everyone wants to learn. It's not just Jessica with her matcha latte and her journal articles. It's the CSR up front who, you know, is on the phone with the clients, you know, and they're asking them questions. We need to make everybody as smart as we possibly can.
Well, we've had this amazing conversation and we've gone all different places. And again, I have no idea where we're going next.
It's our favorite test.
That was kind of what I was thinking. I was just making sure I didn't miss anything in between. But I think you covered a lot of, you know, what would we talk to other people about with fostering that relationship. And I think you guys did a great job of illustrating that. So, yeah, let's talk about some fun stuff. What is your favorite test?
So, as I alluded to before, it's going to be the CBC for me. So the complete blood count, and not just that numerical data. That's a starting point, right? But pairing that with a blood film and looking at those cytograms, right, to me, there's so much reward in putting that together to look at the nuances of that patient. And it changes hourly. So for me as a clinical pathologist, doing that in the practice setting next to a sick patient and then getting to evaluate them 12 or 24 hours later and look for the nuances that say, like, we're on the right tack or I'm worried about a complication, right, that helps redirect, like, our further diagnoses or interventions or something, to me, I found the most reward.
Sure, that makes sense. You do get a lot of information there, and especially with trending results.
Yeah, trending is very right. It becomes so valuable. And again, why that wellness lab work is so important.
Yes. Right?
Because reference intervals are inherently wide.
Right.
Right. So they're established from a certain number of dogs or cats, right? And it's everything from, you know, a one-year-old intact female chihuahua through like a 10-year-old Akita or St. Bernard, right? I mean, like,
right.
Almost a different species.
Right.
Right? And so inherently, even though it's all numbers of health, it gives you a wide reference interval, right? And that means it's actually very insensitive in detecting abnormalities for
sure.
An individual patient. Yeah. So we have their set point of what they look like in health, right? And then we get to see them in periods of ADR, ain't doing right, you know, and trying to evaluate whether it's a behavioral issue or it's truly physical and what's going on, is being able to look at their historical data and then to watch the changes like really sensitively, right? So trending that is so important, and why I see that, I feel like, in the CBC, because it changes in minutes to hours.
Sure, that makes sense. And just to clarify, when you're talking about cytograms, are we talking about dot plots?
Yep, dot plots and histograms.
Oh, gosh, one day I will wrap my head.
Yep, exactly. So whether we're looking at, and the histograms are, you know, those the curves that we watch, where it looks at the populations of the red cells or the platelets.
Okay, one day we'll have to talk about that.
I'll do it.
I've listened to so many actually about it, and it just, you know, like, I'm like, I got it, and then the next day it's gone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, one day we'll come back to that one.
You'll find a lot of reward, I think. So,
yes, I think so. Jessica, what about you? What's your favorite test?
It isn't the CBC. I mean, I like it for all the reasons that Polly just said, but mine really is the in-house fluid analysis. So we do a lot of fluid analysis at our hospital, not only for diagnostics, but then also for trending purposes, like postoperatively. And what a wonderful, like, little window into what's going on inside the abdomen or in the chest or in the joint that we can really give our doctors a lot of information about. And I love the fact that it's really, other than the diagnosis and the collection in some cases, technician driven. So the technicians are processing the sample, we're doing the differentials, making the slides, we're doing all of the things. And it is just a wonderful way to maximize the technicians within your hospital.
That is a really cool answer. I really like that. Was not even on my radar for diagnostic tests, but yeah, you're right. There is a lot of information, and you're talking about post-ops. What kind of post-ops?
So any type of like septic abdomen.
Okay.
Well, you know, maybe they have a Jackson Pratt drain in, so we
yeah.
can just pull the fluid off, and then we can watch those numbers. We can watch the inflammatory cells. If there were intercellular bacteria, we can watch them kind of go away and even die in response to our antibiotics. It's a really great way to kind of know, you know, when your patients turn the corner, or even if you need to go back and redo surgery.
So this is where, right, we found our common spot, right? Because we're looking at this post-operative patient, right? I'm closely watching the CBC and the blood film, right? To look for any complication, right?
Right.
You're a veterinarian, you've taken these dogs to surgery, right? You take out what needs to be taken out. You leave in some things that you think they're pinking up. You think it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Right? But you close them up and you don't know, right? And so we need to use some other objective measurements, right, to assess that, like, everything is going okay, right, and no complications. So Jessica's talking about we'll look at the fluid each day, right, and then watch for any complications, especially days 3 and 4, right, if see if, like, your RNA held or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
So I'm looking at the blood film, but in truth, you know, the CBC can lag up to a day, right, to show those changes. So she's looking at that actual fluid each day, too, as we trend, hopefully together, you know, that things are going the right way. And if there is a complication identified, that we get it addressed before the animal decompensates, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and taking all that information together, which is what we've talked about so many times, of really looking at the patient and the data and putting it all together, which is part of the fun of ClinPath, of putting the puzzle together.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you have a JP drain in, you're pulling fluid off of it anyway, so why would you not just take a peek at it?
Because sometimes I don't like microscopes.
Well, you can use your in-clinic hematology analyzer to get that depleted cell count, because that's really, hematology analyzers are cell counters. I'm like mimicking you right now.
You're doing great.
Hematology analyzers are just cell counters. That's what they do. That's their job. So that total white blood cell count, that's going to be your total nucleated cell count. And that will at least get you in the bucket of, is it going down? Is it going up?
Okay. And then I can decide if I need the microscope or not.
Correct.
Got it.
Okay. All right. I can live with that.
We could do a whole nother talk on fluids as well.
There we go. We have cytograms and fluids. Yes. In the queue. Well, you guys have an amazing give and take. I mean, you can see the relationship, the trust between the two of you, and you have kind of brought that around to give other talks like this. So will you tell our audience where, if they enjoyed this talk, where they can find you?
Sure. We have a little podcast called Tales from the Lab, spelled like dog tales. It's a little kind of pun on tales. And basically, we just tell stories, not like storybook stories.
Once upon a time.
Yeah, once upon a time, there was a dog named Sammy. No, we take cases that we've had at the hospital that have kind of a unique twist or something that we feel is important for our listeners to kind of get and learn, and then we just talk about them. They're about under a half an hour. We'd like to say that they're short enough to listen on your lunch break or in your car or when you're hiding from your kids. So we just share some wisdom on there and do a lot of this back and forth. We kind of, you know, try to make it fun, but it'll get the listeners to learn something from it.
And Jessica's added in some tech talks, some smaller little episodes, because we found that as we go and talk about a case that, oh, there's a technique that we should mention,
oh,
right? It's not as easy to insert in the middle of a conversation around a case, right? But then she'll go back and afterward and talk about the blood film review or the effusion analysis.
Oh, okay. Like,
so we have tidbits in there for the technicians in the lab as well.
I say also maybe for the veterinarians who don't love microscopes.
Yeah.
Yes, we can help you too.
Yes, for them.
Fantastic.
I was just going to say, we have an Instagram page as well, Tales from the Lab. And it's nice because any of the stuff, you know, Holly's struggling to tell you what Morula looked like on a blood film. We have images that go along with our stories so that way we can reference those. You can go look at them and kind of see any of the radiographs or the lab work or the blood film so that it just makes it a little more comprehensive.
Absolutely. Well, fantastic. Well, thank you both for joining me. This has been so much fun. I've learned a lot, you know, both just in a lot of different facets. So thank you for such a wonderful talk. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having us. This was really exciting.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. Jessica, Holly, what a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. And thank you so much to Antech for making this episode possible. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. It'll help other veterinary professionals find this and other great content we try to put out there. For more episodes like this, click on the Education tab on the VetFolio website. As always, we'd love to hear your input on this talk, as well as ideas for topics you'd like to hear from us in the future. Feel free to reach out to me at dvm@vetfolio.com. You can also visit my Facebook page at Dr. Cassie DVM, and you can find me on LinkedIn.
And remember, if one animal is better off because of you today, it's a great day.